Welcome to the podcast series, Blindingly Obvious. My name is Minnie Baragwanath, and this series is based on my book by the same name. Blindingly Obvious is my story. It is a candid and deeply personal story about my life and work as a blind woman, social entrepreneur, and innovator. I wrote it in order to share my experience of blindness with others, and in the hope that it might raise awareness and invite others to actively create a more accessible future, one that is full of possibility. A wonderful voiceover artist and now friend of mine, Romy Hooper, has narrated my full book, all 24 chapters. I do so hope you enjoy listening. It is an absolute pleasure to be able to share it with you.
16. Birthing a new future. I made a promise to the universe. I promised that somehow I would do something of equal value to that of my unborn child. I would dedicate my life to birthing a fairer, more equitable world, one where no one feels devalued, where no one feels that they are a burden simply for being who they are. I wanted a world where everyone could just be. The very first seed of with was now planted deep within me. But I did not have that language or that understanding at that time. Instead, I mostly felt deep sadness, failure, and shame. I had said no to something unbelievably precious, but yes to the unknown, the possible. I had said no to being a victim of a disabling world, and I was saying yes to being able to define and shape a different future. It was a deeply private choice and commitment that I had made with the universe. One that I am only now sharing for the very first time. I had always tried to reject being narrowly defined. I had always tried to step out of the predictable. But now, I had a power inside me unlike anything I had experienced before. This was now about so much more than just me. As I mentioned, the extraordinary thing about the word with is that it contains the meaning midwife. Being a midwife, supporting a mother to enable the safe birth of her child, seems to me to be the ultimate example of what it means to be with. It means to be in deep harmony and in deep partnership when creating something sacred, something beyond ourselves. I now wholeheartedly dedicated myself to supporting the birth of a fairer world. But what would I need to be able to do this most effectively? How did I need to plan and prepare? How would I need to equip myself to be the best I could? And who would also need to be a part of this too? Who would have what it takes to birth this fairer world with me? In 2006, I found myself on a flight to Australia, my first step towards acquiring the skills and the knowledge I needed to birth this new future. The city of Melbourne had a very interesting local government disability program underway, and I wanted to learn more about it. In the hope I could bring some insights back to Auckland City Council. In my experience, there are some things in life that we plan and aim to achieve, and we are hugely intentional about. But often it is the unexpected or the unplanned things that are the life-changing ones. The trick is to know what to pay attention to, if possible. During one of my meetings in the fabulous city of Melbourne, I was told about an event that was happening that evening at a local bank. It was the launch of a new leadership program called Leadership Plus. This was a program entirely dedicated to the development of disability leadership. Leadership Plus had grown out of another incredible program called Leadership Victoria. So after quickly rearranging my plans for that evening, I took a chance and went along to the launch of this wonderful program. To my delight, I witnessed the power of accessibility being shown the respect it deserved. Instead of being held out the back of a rundown hall, this glamorous opening event was being hosted in the foyer of one of Australia's largest and most prestigious banks. I felt as if disabled Australians were not only seen, they were actually valued. The next day, I met up with the CEO of Leadership Plus, Stephen. Not only was he a wonderfully engaging character and the CEO of a fascinating organisation, he too was partially blind. Yippee! How absolutely fantastic! Our lifelong friendship had begun. It was so precious to have someone who was also striving to drive social change. who was doing it in a way that I admired, and who was also partially blind. Even though we did not have the same sight conditions, there was enough that felt similar for this to be very powerful and strengthening. One of the funniest blind moments that has ever happened in my life occurred when Stephen and I went to the zoo together on one of his trips to New Zealand. We were both staring intently into an enclosure. I said, "I guess it must be empty." Stephen agreed. We could not see anything in there. Then a small boy arrived at the enclosure with his mother and said, "Mummy, look at the elephants." We laughed our heads off for the rest of the day. In Australia, I knew instantly that this leadership program was the one for me, and that this was what I needed at this point in my life. This was what I needed to enable me to fulfill my new mission. Stephen and I looked into the possibility of me applying and coming across at regular points throughout the year to participate, but it sadly proved impossible. However, all was far from lost. Stephen told me that a group in New Zealand had recently started their own leadership program. It was not one dedicated to the development of leaders with disability, but was, for want of a better expression, a mainstream program called Leadership New Zealand. He put me in touch with the impressive founder, Joe Brosnahan, and the incredible new CEO, Leslie Slade. That encounter, that friendship and collegial relationship with Leslie, was the start of the most extraordinary, defining, and transformative time in my life. But more on that later. I had a leadership program to apply for. By the time I got back to New Zealand and connected with Leslie, the application period for Leadership New Zealand was nearly over for that year. Fortunately, I managed to slip in my application in the nick of time. One of the things the application required was that if we were successful, we would receive financial sponsorship from our employer. When Leslie called to say that I had been selected, I set about seeking this support. I was, after all, the first disabled person and the one and only blind person they had had on Leadership New Zealand. And this was part of their journey to ensure true diversity on the program. Well, support was not forthcoming. Sadly, that very same senior manager yet again failed to step up. I was told that I would not receive any support from the council, where I had now worked for 7 years. What's more, my manager laughed when I had told her how important it would be for me and my work to be able to meet and engage with other people from other organisations. When I told Leslie what had happened, the team at Leadership New Zealand demonstrated the most extraordinary generosity. They offered me a fully funded, fully sponsored place on the program. I was overwhelmed. Someone truly, deeply believed in me and my potential and was prepared to invest in my growth and development. I was utterly overjoyed. Was this what with felt like? Like many New Zealanders, I had an awkward relationship with the concept of leadership. I certainly struggled to apply the label of leader to myself. What I did know at this time was that I had made a life-changing, wholehearted commitment to advance a more equitable world. And if this was called leadership, then I needed to step up and into it. There are some times in our lives that we know are golden, and this was one such year for me. I absolutely loved the program. I loved the total experience. Every month we would have the privilege of hearing about life, society, the economy, culture, and much, much more. From the most incredible array of New Zealand leaders. We had leaders from across the private sector. We had entrepreneurs. We had senior government officials. We had politicians. We had artists and community leaders. We had iwi leaders and Pacific leaders. We slept on marae. We visited the Mangere Refugee Centre. We visited world-class agricultural plants and toured the beehive. And we spent hours together discussing and exploring what was this thing we call leadership. And what's more, it was virtually entirely oral, based on the power of conversation. I did not have to see in order to participate fully. Leslie Slade, the CEO of LNZ at the time, is a remarkable woman. She exudes this gracious, stylish energy and just happens to have the most fabulous inquiring brain too. Leslie had and has very definite ideas about leadership, what it is and absolutely what it is not. I still believe she is without a doubt one of the top leadership practitioners in Aotearoa to this day. There are two amazing writers and thinkers on leadership that Leslie admires hugely, and as a result, that showed up a lot in our program with her. They are Peter Block and Margaret Wheatley. If you have not read their work, you must. Thanks entirely to Leslie, to this day I am still closely involved with Margaret Wheatley's work and remain deeply influenced by her dedication to what it means to be human in the 21st century. While I learnt so much from being on the LNZ program in 2007, it really was just the start of something so much more. It was the most extraordinary catalyst for change. And a critical part of this had to do with the lifelong relationships that were created as a result of this experience. I feel absolutely certain that without my time on LNZ, my baby, Be Accessible, our social change agency, would quite possibly never have been born a few years later. For a period of time in the first years of Be, just about every key member of my team was either a former employee of LNZ, an alumni, or had been a speaker on the program. That is how important and powerful the relationships and the LNZ experience had been for me and for accessibility social change in Aotearoa. It meant that we all had a shared language and some shared frameworks for thinking about leadership and social change. And we had some shared models for working across sectors and embracing diversity. But perhaps the most powerful thing that stayed with me after this program year was the realization that all of the people who had come and presented to us during that year had one particular thing in common. They did not wait for someone else to step up. If there was something they felt needed doing, changing, or creating, they got on with it and somehow found a way to make it happen, despite often crazy setbacks and challenges. I realized leadership was often about stepping forward in the belief that something needs to change, and or that something new is possible. In the spirit of Margaret Wheatley, leadership happens when we see something. We keep on seeing it and we cannot ignore it. So eventually we simply have to take action, to try and do something about it. We feel deeply compelled to act. It dawned on me that I had been unconsciously waiting for things to change. I had unconsciously been waiting for someone else, someone more qualified or senior, or whatever it was, to step up and lead the transformation that was so needed to advance a more accessible Aotearoa. Of course, there were, and still are, people who are doing this in the most remarkable ways, every day of the year. But I just knew deep inside that I wanted to approach accessibility social change in a very particular way. And I could not see anyone else approaching it the way I believed it needed to happen. This realization, that perhaps I had something different or unique to offer, was key. After such a long time of feeling ghettoized at the bottom of the council hierarchy, with little or no opportunity to upskill or be exposed to world-changing ideas and people, another incredible opportunity opened up for me, alongside the LNZ one, in 2007. Through my work and interest in community development, and the importance of community-led development in particular, I had come across an extraordinary organization in Canada called Tamarack. Tamarack ran a number of amazing programs, operating mostly with a focus on ending poverty and building places of belonging. In September 2007, Tamarack was hosting a program to share its many learnings and insights with practitioners in a small town called Hamilton, just outside Toronto in Ontario. I sent an application to attend the conference to the organisers in Canada, and to my surprise, I was accepted. However, it turns out that the Tamarack head office perhaps thought I was part of a different, separate contingency from Aotearoa that was going there to study their approach and bring it back to New Zealand. This group were all being sponsored by Stephen Tindall, the same Stephen Tindall who had set up the warehouse chain of businesses in Aotearoa. Many people do not know that Stephen has for years consistently funded and supported the most extraordinary array of social change initiatives in New Zealand. So I arrived in Canada to find that a group of New Zealanders were also there, some of whom I knew a little bit. One in particular, was later to become a treasured and founding board member of Be Accessible, Mary Jane Rivers. Tamarack had taken the concept of cross-sector development to a whole new level. They had trialled and implemented a range of programs throughout Canada to eradicate poverty through this approach. The city of Hamilton was one such community where this approach had been applied. The simple idea was that by identifying a common goal that everyone could support, you would engage all sectors of the community in that vision. So, for example, the anti-poverty slogan for Hamilton was, "The best place in Canada to raise a child." Who could argue against that, or not support it as a vision? The challenge then became how to ensure all voices would be equally heard around the table, especially the disenfranchised. Well, theory is one thing, but real life is quite another, and I knew at first hand how complex this can actually be. In Auckland, I had recently had my own very direct experience of what can happen when there is not a shared sense of community and a shared desire for collective well-being. I had been lucky enough to purchase a small one-bedroom apartment. While it was incredibly wonderful to have my own place at last, especially after my time with James, all was not straightforward. I was living in a block of apartments built some time ago, in the 1960s. They had all originally been built as social housing. Then many had eventually been sold off to private owners in the late 1990s. I would estimate that of the 30 apartments, half were still social housing, a quarter were privately owned but rented out, and a quarter were owner-occupiers like myself. Most of the owners and renters were simply focused on themselves and what they could get. Yes, we paid a body corporate fee, but there was little, if any, sense of collective well-being, and this proved disastrous. The social housing providers, on the other hand, seemed totally disengaged and also uninterested in the idea of a collective vision. In fact, from my point of view, many of these seemed to be failing dismally to care for their clients at all. Most people do not believe me when I tell them what went on during this period in my life, so I have rarely shared this experience. We had all been muddling along for some time. Not perfect, but sort of okay. Then one day, everything changed. It was as if a volatile chemical reaction had occurred. Suddenly, everything seemed to unravel, become toxic, incredibly sad, distressing, and yes, dangerous too. I woke up one day to hear voices next door. My sweet, reclusive neighbor had been lying in her room, dead for 2 days. She had killed herself. I had had no idea she was lying dead in the apartment next door to me. Within 3 months, two other neighbors also committed suicide. It was devastating. A young woman would regularly walk about the grounds of the apartment block, seemingly oblivious to the fact that she was covered in menstrual blood. She also never closed her curtains, if she in fact had any, so any Tom, Dick, or Harriet could look in her bed whenever they wanted. And they did. No one ever seemed to be there to support her. Another neighbour developed a vendetta against cats and started trying to drown neighbourhood cats if they ventured into his garden. Luckily, my cat Oscar was exempt. However, he did try to cash a cheque he stole from my chequebook for $5,000. Luckily, I did not have anywhere near that much money in my account. One upside of not having a vast salary. The same neighbour also regularly stuffed rotting meat and other organic waste from the rubbish bins into a car engine belonging to a different neighbour that for some reason he did not like. One night, I awoke to hear another neighbour smashing multiple glass front doors throughout the block. He then returned to his home and smashed up his own bathroom with bricks and a mallet. A few days later, a different neighbour threatened to shoot someone in our block with a gun he had now acquired. And there were regular drug deals going on in the car park below my window. For months, local street workers would use our shared laundry room for their nighttime enterprises, attracting an extremely dodgy clientele to our homes. They would then circumnavigate our apartments, scanning any open windows to see what they could steal as they walked past. This was the tip of the iceberg. This is where I now lived as a single blind woman. This is where I lived on my own for 8 years. It occurred to me that perhaps one of the main reasons we were experiencing this situation was that no one really cared enough to do anything about it. For community to exist, we must care deeply about each other. How else will we ever be with each other? There was certainly no shared goal around creating a wonderful home and a happy, healthy community at my apartment block. There simply was not a deep commitment by the right people to do something about it. And the people who were most drastically impacted were the silent and the voiceless. They were not invited to the body corporate meetings, and there was no other collective forum in which they could be heard. And I could not find anyone willing to work with me to try and shift this terribly sad and deeply unhealthy situation. So there were many reasons why the work being undertaken by Tamarack resonated with me and profoundly impacted on me. I was directly living the reality of complex issues that arise as a result of poverty, mental health provision, social policy, capitalism, and yes, a disabling society. Tamarack had identified that it is critical that we are able to differentiate between different simple, complicated, and complex social challenges. The reason why this model or framework for thinking and approaching social change is so absolutely vital is that all too often, society approaches complex issues such as access to housing, poverty, climate change, and, yes, accessibility, as if they are a simple challenge or situation. We then wonder why we are not significantly impacting on these issues when applying cookie-cutter, formulaic, simple solution after simple solution. This model shows us that those areas, which are complex in our world today, require a very particular approach, one that is fit for purpose, one that meets the needs of a complex social issue, and one that employs systems thinking. If we were ever to stand a chance to create an equitable world for access citizens, this was the type of approach we needed. I was starting to fully appreciate that community comes in many forms in life, and I could see how important community is. One of the most powerfully positive and wonderful experiences I have ever had of community came a few years later, in a rather fabulous and unexpected form. A very dear and treasured friend of mine, Atlanta, told me about a group of women who had started up a sort of synchronized swimming performance troupe called the Wet Hot Bitches, later to become the Wet Hot Beauties, because it was more media friendly. For several years, a group of mostly women would meet at various locations, including the Parnell Baths, to rehearse the most brilliant, fun, hilarious water performance spectacles. It was the first time in years that I had been part of a group activity like this, one where I felt equal and truly welcomed. Our performances were influenced by the synchronized swimmers of the 1940s. While we all wore black bathing suits, white bathing caps, and bright red lipstick, we definitely added a 21st century twist to our performances. Some of our performances had up to 60 people, all being choreographed in the pool at the same time. We all moved in harmony to pieces of music, and one entire show was dedicated to Michael Jackson, before all the details of his predilections emerged. If you watched us from above, we looked at times like black and white flowering sea anemones, opening and closing, all made up of groups of women. One performance was held at night once the sun went down. Well, for someone who is blind and who has particularly bad night vision, you can imagine how difficult, and yes, hilarious, it was. I was trying to stick to the choreography when I could barely see, and everyone looked basically identical anyway. Let's just say that I ended up grabbing on to a lot of different women's swimsuits so as not to lose the person I was supposed to be following in the water. The thing about this that brought me so much joy was that this was all about having fun. It was all about simply connecting with women of all ages, sizes, backgrounds, and walks of life. Our only purpose being to create something fabulous together that we could share with friends and family. The fact that we ended up winning in some of the fringe arts festivals with our shows was to me just a bonus. I know that when the day comes and I am on my deathbed, I will recall this time in this community of women as one of the most fabulous and treasured times in my life. Many of my closest friends today were a part of that experience. And one friend, a journalist,
regularly write stories about accessibility social change as a result of our friendship during this time. That, to me, is true community. Go on, Google us. Google the Wet Hot Beauties. You will love what you see. Not all my time in Canada was spent in intense explorations of society. I certainly did have time to go out and have fun, and yes, experience community in an entirely different way. It turned out that during one weekend I was there, the world finals of the game Rock, Paper, Scissors were being held. The what, you ask? Yes, that is right. It turns out that Rock, Paper, Scissors is a serious game. Sort of. I had met up with a friend of a friend, and she had taken me to this hilarious and quite crazy event. There were hundreds and hundreds of rather drunk people in this huge stadium, all going around to complete strangers and challenging them to a game. We met this very funny guy from the UK, who had come across with a group of friends especially to take part in this event. If they had time, they were also going to go to Niagara Falls the next day. But without a doubt, this felt secondary. As the night progressed, the serious players were gradually being whittled out on stage. You can imagine my delight when the announcement came that the new world champion was a guy from New Zealand. I was filled with national pride. Roll over the All Blacks, rock, paper, scissors just might be our new national sport. Being exposed to world-leading work and community-led development, seeing the power of cross-sector engagement and action, meeting other passionate agents of change, and spending time in the wonderful city of Toronto was further fuel for my passion to advance access. I felt that I was now acquiring some of the specialized skills and frameworks for thinking and looking at accessibility that would equip me to be effective in advancing change. I felt so refreshed and revigorated being out of New Zealand and gaining new perspective on my life and work. At the end of my year with LNZ, I took a week off. I wanted time to digest what I had learned that year and to explore what next for Mini B. However, much to my surprise, what I wrote was not so much a what next for Mini, but a vision for an accessible Aotearoa. I had combined all that I had learned with LNZ with all that I had experienced and learnt in Canada that year with Tamarack, plus the work with Mark's model and my time at the council, all to create a vision for an accessible future. My commitment to upskilling, to preparing myself to a life in social change, was well underway. However, to my mind, there was still an obvious gap in my knowledge, something I needed to address before I would be truly ready to effect change. Comprehensive accessibility transformation must include the economy. It is, after all, a pivotal part of the disabling world. I was about to enroll in the fabulous and groundbreaking Postgraduate Diploma of Economic Development at AUT and to begin to study a new field, the social economy. Trust me, it is more exciting than it sounds.
I do so hope you enjoyed listening to my book and podcast series, Blindingly Obvious. It has been an absolute privilege to be able to share this with you. Listen out for the next chapter coming soon. If you would like to purchase the entire book in audio or an array of other accessible formats, including New Zealand Sign Language, or to learn more about my work, visit my website, minib.co.nz. Thank you for taking the time to listen and to be with me. See you next time. With love, Minnie B.